Hi, everybody. This is Dennis Prager. The third hour of my Tuesday show each week is devoted to some great issue of life. Incredibly, when I think about it, in all these years, I have never devoted an hour to evolution. I'm not a scientist, and I have devoted many hours to God and arguments for God, and I have debated every prominent atheist except for Dawkins, and this has been a big theme of mine, but not evolution. And so I am devoting this hour to evolution because by sheer coincidence, or perhaps, if you will, design, fine-tuning, sure enough, this book comes out today on a Tuesday. Could have come out any one of six other days, but it came out on Ultimate Issues Day. And it is major. In fact, to my very pleasant surprise, I'm looking on Amazon. It is the number 9 best-selling book in all of Amazon. Folks, you have no idea how spectacular that is. A New York Times bestseller will be under 100. And that includes, of course, fiction in the Amazon. They don't make a distinction. Everything included. So it is clearly already starting to make waves, as it should. The book is titled Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life. The subtitle is very important here. The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. So, too, the title is important, and I'm going to discuss both of those immediately. The author is Stephen Meyer, and Dr. Meyer has his PhD from Cambridge in the philosophy of science. Sometimes he is attacked as not being fully scientist because he got his PhD at Cambridge in the philosophy of science, but you have to know a lot of science to get a PhD in the philosophy of science at Cambridge or any other distinguished institution, and he is indeed a scientist. And this is the book coming out today, Darwin's Doubt. So, Dr. Meyer, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Dennis, it's awfully nice to be with you.
Yes, we tend to be with each other more frequently than not now. We were together in France last week and in America by phone this week. And I want to begin with analyzing the title. So what was Darwin's Doubt? What are you referring to in your title?
That's a great place to start. The doubt that Darwin had about his own theory was a doubt about the origin of animal life. The very first animals on Earth appeared very suddenly in the fossil record. If you go through the piles of strata, you've got the oldest strata on the bottom, and as you go up the column, it gets younger and younger, and you get to a particular layer in the sedimentary record all around the world, and suddenly you get the first complex animals. And Darwin was aware of this, and he was aware that it contradicted the picture of the history of life that he had painted in his otherwise masterful theory in the origin of species, the idea of a kind of gradual unfolding or morphing from simple to complex. But these first simple complex animals appeared very suddenly without precursors in the lower strata, and that mystified him.
And that's called the Cambrian Explosion.
That's right. Today we call that the Cambrian Explosion, but Darwin was aware of it, called some, a little something different at the time, but that's what we call it.
So Darwin acknowledged that there could be a challenge to his own theory.
Yeah, absolutely. He said that the evidence of the Cambrian Explosion presented a challenge to, quote, the views here entertained. He said it was a valid objection. He, of course, hoped that subsequent fossil finds would fill in those missing transitional intermediate forms from the very simplest forms of life to the first complex animals. But as paleontologists have investigated the Precambrian rocks, the Precambrian sedimentary rocks around the world, no such ancestral precursors have turned up. And so the mystery has, if anything, deepened in the 150 years since Darwin first published The Origin.
If I had Darwin on my show and presented him with this, what would he say in your opinion?
I think he would say pretty much what he said in The Origin, that it was an unexplained mystery and something that was a major, actually at the time he viewed it as a minor anomaly, something that was just one small thing that he couldn't explain weighed against all the things that he could. But one of the arguments of the book is that that small little anomaly has grown up to be illustrative of a major problem in evolutionary biology, one, in fact, that is underwriting a crisis in evolutionary thinking, because not only do we have the problem of the missing fossils, we have a much deeper mystery, the mystery of how you build such complex animals, the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations and variations is increasingly seen by many scientists to lack the creative power to produce such exquisite and complex animals and organs that we see arising so suddenly in the fossil record.
So let me turn this around. If there were intermediate fossils, you would not have written your book.
Well, that's the initial point of departure. It's the first aspect of the mystery. But even if there were intermediate fossils, you still have this deeper mystery. And it's one which is how do you build an animal? It's an engineering problem. And this mystery has become more acute, not just because of the missing fossils, and the fossils are still missing, but also because of what we've learned about what it takes to build an animal, especially in the last half of the 20th century, where it became clear in biology that information, literally digital code stored in the DNA molecule and information stored elsewhere, is running the show in life. And if you want to build an animal, you've got to have code, you've got to have information. And yet, what we know from, say, our experience with software is that random changes in digital information tends to degrade information, not generate new information. And so there's a big problem with building animals. You got to have code, you got to have circuitry, you have to have all these features of organisms, of developing animals that we associate with our own world of high technology, but which random mutation and natural selection don't seem capable of producing.
You are welcome, especially those of you who feel that scientists challenging evolution is just wrong. You are certainly welcome now to call in 1-8-PRAGER-776, 877-243-7776. Let's see, there are citations by a number of esteemed paleontologists. That's the people who study specifically fossils. What is a paleontologist by definition?
Right. A paleontologist is an expert on ancient life as preserved typically in the fossil record.
Okay. So there are a number of paleontologists who have acknowledged that there is a real problem with the origin of the species. That's the title, of course, of Darwin's seminal book. Because of the fossil record. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right.
Would you give some examples?
Well, there's a major book out this year by James Valentine and Doug Irwin. Valentine's a professor emeritus at UC Berkeley, Irwin at the Smithsonian. Their book is also on the Cambrian explosion. They're not proponents of intelligent design, but they acknowledge that the Cambrian explosion is a huge mystery in the history of life. And the review that came out about their book in Science just a week or two ago said that the book documents the grand puzzle of the Cambrian explosion and that it ranks as one of the outstanding mysteries of evolutionary biology. So essentially, they and I agree about the science. We have a difference about how to solve the problem.
Well, how do they, in a nutshell, how do they solve the problem?
Well, they sketch an approach to how you would solve the problem, saying that we need to bring into the conversation scientific evidence from a variety of fields and take a more interdisciplinary approach, looking at evidence from paleontology as well as developmental biology and what we know about ancient environments. But I don't think they offer a very specific solution at this point. Instead, they favor what they call a non-uniformitarian explanation, which is to say that whatever caused the Cambrian explosion, it was not produced by any biological process we see at work today.
All right. I'll be back. This is the Ultimate Issues Hour. The book is out today, Darwin's Doubt: The Explosive Origin of Animal Life. That's what the Cambrian Explosion is. Where did they come from? We don't have a fossil record that leads there. The book is a big challenge to evolution as understood, or perhaps evolution, period. 1-8-PRAGER-776. You are invited to challenge the professor. I'm Dennis Prager. Hello, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Today, a major work, and I don't say that often, it has been published. This is the official date. Darwin's Doubt. I have never had a show, I've never had an hour on evolution. It's one of the only important topics that I have never discussed because I knew that I didn't know enough to discuss it. Simple as that. But this man does. He has a doctorate from Cambridge University in the philosophy of science and is a scientist, and he is with the Discovery Institute in Seattle. He has written another major book, which we did have him on for, The Signature in the Cell, which when he was talking about information, that's what he was talking about. Just as computer code gives us information, there is actually information, living information. Is that a way to put it?
Well, I'd say maybe information that makes it possible to be alive.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
And this is the second book, but one is not dependent upon the other. The Darwin Doubt, and I'll put it in lay terms, I always do this with guests who are deeply versed in a subject so that I could put it in as clear a term as possible for my listeners and for me so that I know that I got it. Darwin said in his own book, The Origin of Species, and by the way, folks, that's an important title because he says this is how species originated. And you're looking at what is called the Cambrian explosion when at a given point, the fossil record shows animal life in a more complex variety seem to arise out of nowhere, as it were. And indeed, he said that is a challenge to my theory. So hopefully we will simply find the fossil record that leads up to the Cambrian explosion. But your point is there is no such fossil record.
The fossils that he hoped to find didn't materialize. That's absolutely right. And what has materialized is a richer fossil record of additional Cambrian forms, each of which in turn lack the ancestral forms that his theory would imply should be there for those new forms. So we have, in a sense, more missing links, more gaps in that pre-Cambrian record because of the new and exotic animal forms that have been discovered since his time.
Who is Mark McMenamin?
He's a paleontologist at Mount Holyoke College on the East Coast and author of several important books in paleontology, one on the emergence of animals with Columbia University Press.
All right, so he's a distinguished paleontologist, and I want to read to you a quote from him with regard to your book. It is hard for us paleontologists, steeped as we are in a tradition of Darwinian analysis, to admit that neo-Darwinian explanations for the Cambrian explosion have failed miserably. New data acquired in recent years, instead of solving Darwin's dilemma, have rather made it worse. Meyer, that's my guest, Stephen Meyer, describes the dimensions of the problem with clarity and precision. His book is a game changer for the study of evolution and evolutionary biology. Stephen Meyer points us in the right direction as we seek a new theory for the origin of Cambrian animal phyla. That's a big deal. Tell us what Stephen Gould of Harvard, the famous Harvard paleontologist, what he concluded after studying the problem of the Cambrian explosion.
Well, Gould was a fascinating figure, not only a great scientist, but a great translator of scientific ideas into the popular vernacular. He had a great column that he used to do. But he was also known for developing a new theory of evolution in the late 1970s and early 80s called punctuated equilibrium. And he and his co-author, Niles Eldredge, recognized when they were fairly young scientists that the fossil record just wasn't producing the evidence of the gradual transformation that Darwin had anticipated. And they finally had an insight. In fact, Eldredge had it first, and he put it very aphoristically. He said that stasis, which is paleontology talk for things aren't changing, stasis is data. And what they were saying is that when we look at the fossil record, we have to take the evidence at face value and stop trying to connect dots where there's no dots to be connected. And so they came up with a new theory of evolution, which they called punctuated equilibrium. It was the idea that the major innovations in the history of life occur very rapidly, and then those forms of life that arise in that manner stay the same for a very long time.
Yeah, but how did they explain those rapid changes?
Well, that was the rub. Their theory was a more accurate description of the fossil record, but their critics said they didn't really come up with a mechanism that could generate the sudden appearance of new forms of life that quickly. And Gould wrote his magnum opus at the very end of his life. He essentially acknowledged that he did not have a mechanism that was any different than good old-fashioned, slow-acting, natural selection operating on random mutations. So it was a real exciting kind of innovation in evolutionary theory in the 1970s and 80s that gradually kind of petered out. In the end, it was seen as a nice description of the fossil record, but not a theory that had provided a mechanism that could explain this sudden appearance.
All right, we're going to take some calls from around the country. We'll begin in California. And Bob, hi, Bob. You're on with Stephen Meyer, author of Darwin's Doubt, which is, of course, up at DennisPrager.com. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi, Dennis. I'm sorry, I didn't know you were on me. There's a couple of things, questions that I've always thought of. For something, there has to be an organism with no eyes. All of a sudden, they have an eye with a million cones, a million rods, all the muscles, all the fibers, all the brain to hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, and two eyes so you get depth perception. Where is the fossil records of an animal with only 50 rods? It wouldn't be useful to pass it on to somebody.
Go ahead, Stephen Meyer.
Well, it's a very compelling point that you make, Bob. I actually have in my home office where I'm sitting doing this interview a fossil of several trilobites preserved. You're going to get me talking like a geek here, but one of them is so exquisitely preserved that you can see the compound structure of the eye in this ancient arthropod. What's so fascinating about this is you have this amazing level of complexity from the very dawn of animal life. And it's really quite extraordinary when you think about what would be required to build an organ, much less a whole organism of that complexity. So it's one of the things that makes the Cambrian explosion a more acute problem. Not only do you have the origin of whole animals, but you have these exquisite organs that require a lot of engineering.
All right, when we come back, I want you to describe, you deal with the greatest six arguments against you in your book. I want to deal with a few of them. Take more of your calls. I'm going to let some of you go because I want to get those who differ with the doctor in a moment. First time ever that I'm devoting an hour on my show, which is amazing because we really do talk about just about everything. But I've never felt equipped to just talk about evolution as such. And the only thing that I ever used to say, and I still would say that, is that the notion that science shows that there cannot possibly be a designer is absurd. That part I thought was absurd. Whenever I did take a position, I would say, well, if evolution is correct, then God used evolution. And I couldn't care less, and I'm very happy to go on with my day. But the fact is that evolution is a huge issue, obviously. It is almost a religious issue for many people who believe in it. And it may or may not be true, but here we have a challenge that is, as this paleontologist I cited last segment, whose latest book was published by Columbia University, says this book is a game changer. It's already number 9, which for a book on evolution is astonishing. I can't tell you, Stephen Meyer, how happy I am. I couldn't believe it because I know what Amazon numbers are like. I'm totally open with my audience. I'll be, and obviously with you. My last book made the New York Times bestseller list, but it never got under, I think, 70 on Amazon. And so 9 is just extraordinary. So this is a, after all, if you write a game changer and nobody reads it, it doesn't change the game. So, it needs to be read. And by the way, folks, it's important for you to understand that lay people can understand his book. And I am such an individual. So we were talking about the challenges. You deal with 6. Why don't you describe them in a nutshell, if you can? It's a big task. But what are the biggest challenges that you have to answer?
Well, in the book, I think what you're referring to is the successive critiques I make of the creative power of the Darwinian mechanism of random mutations and natural selection. And those critiques start with the observation that the Cambrian explosion and other similar events in the history of life are not just explosions of new form. Since Watson and Crick, who discovered that DNA contains information in a digital form and that the evolutionary process needs information to build anything new, we have recognized that the Cambrian explosion is actually an information explosion. When you get a new animal, you've got to have new cell types. To have those new cell types, you need new proteins. And to build those proteins, you've got to have a lot of new genetic information. You've got to have digital code to construct those proteins. So that's the big question. Where did all the information come from? And one of the problems that first emerged in the discussion of modern evolutionary theory that was a challenge to the theory. It started back in the 1960s with a group of professors from MIT who were mathematicians, computer scientists, physicists. They were guys that worked with numbers. And they started challenging their biology colleagues to put numbers on the probabilities, on the scenarios that they were envisioning as to how new animal forms would arise, how even new proteins would arise. And they were very skeptical from a quantitative standpoint. And here's a way of illustrating it. If you have a combination lock and you have three dials, you don't just have 10 plus 10 plus 10 possibilities. You get 10 possibilities at each dial. You've got 10 times 10 times 10 possibilities.
Right, right.
That's it. And this is the idea of what's called a combinatorial or combination. Well, to illustrate the problem with proteins and with genes, DNA, I had one of our artists depict a lock with 10 dials. And there you don't have just 1,000 possibilities. You've got 10 to the 10th or 10
right.
billion
10 times 10 times 10 times 10.
So,
right.
Yeah. So yeah. This is an illustration of the problem. Imagine that you've got a thief who's randomly searching for that one functional combination out of those 10 billion possibilities. If a security guard is coming around the corner in the next 3 or 4 minutes, he can spin the dials really, really fast, and he's only going to search a very small portion of those 10 billion possibilities. So it's going to be much more likely than not that he will fail to find the combination in the time allowed than that he will succeed.
And, of course, the guardsman who's going to come is the time of the universe or the time of the world?
Exactly, exactly.
Well,
in the known time of the universe, you don't have enough time to search the possibility
right.
of finding the new protein.
That's what people need to understand. There isn't unlimited time. I will be back. Darwin's Doubt. Stephen Meyer. I'm Dennis Prager. What was before, we see once more. Is our kingdom a distant light? You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show, the Ultimate Issues Hour, and the first one on evolution in my show's history. The author of a major, major work, both in terms of its sales, which begin today, as it's released today by Harper One, and in terms of its content, I read to you what one paleontologist said. We paleontologists have to realize this book is a game changer. Stephen Meyer holds a PhD from Cambridge in the philosophy of science. What he has done here is taken Darwin at his word. That's why it's titled Darwin's Doubt. He knew that there was what is called this Cambrian explosion. That is at a period of history, obviously prehistory as we understand it, there was an explosion of much more complex animal forms than had ever existed. So Darwin acknowledges that if there's no findings of fossils that lead up to this complexity of life in the Cambrian explosion, his theory has problems. So Darwin's Doubt is the name of the book and appropriately titled. Now, the second part of your subtitle is The Case for Intelligent Design. Let's explain for a moment, because it's very important, and I don't care what your answer is, but I want clarity here. It is frequently by the critics of intelligent design, there are two major critiques, neither of which I find compelling at all, but I'd like you to respond. One is, how could science ever suggest something that itself is not scientifically provable? That's the first one. And the other one is that it's just a fancy word for creationism. So why don't you take those two?
Let's take the first one first, because it's more important. Obviously, just from what we've said so far, I developed a scientific critique of the modern form of Darwinian evolution. The mechanism doesn't have the capacity to generate the information needed to build these new animals in a nutshell. But I don't just stop with a critique. What I actually do is I use the very method of scientific reasoning that Darwin himself used to analyze the problem. And when I was first getting into this subject and wondering if it was possible to formulate a positive scientific argument or theory of intelligent design, I ironically was studying Darwin's method of scientific reasoning very closely, because what he did is develop a method that allowed scientists to investigate events in the remote past. And he had a principle of reasoning, which was that if you want to explain an event in the remote past, you should look for a cause which is known to have the power to produce the effects in question. In other words, what we should look at the cause and effect structure of the world, what happens around us, and invoke only such causes to explain events in the past which we know from our present experience are capable of explaining the key features of, in this case, life. Well, when I got to the problem of the origin of information, I asked myself a question. What is the cause of which we know that's capable of producing new information? There's lots of reasons to doubt that random mutation and natural selection can do that, but we do know of a cause that produces information, that produces digital code, and that cause is intelligence. In fact, one early information scientist who applied information theory to molecular biology said that information habitually arises from conscious activity. And so as I began to think about how to apply Darwin's method of scientific reasoning to the problem of the origin of life and the origin of animal form, and realizing that in both cases we were dealing with information explosions, it seemed really obvious that intelligent design was a legitimate scientific explanation because it met this key criterion. It provided a cause that was consistent with what we knew about cause and effect from our present experience. Only intelligence produces information. The key thing that has to be explained in the Cambrian explosion is the information explosion that makes these animals possible.
That's a good answer. You see, I was fearing you were going to use the word God. I believe in God, but that's a separate issue. But you're pointing out that people have to explain, this is another way of putting it, and tell me if it's legitimate. People have to explain where in life they could ever have seen that intelligence comes from non-intelligence.
Right. And the irony here is I'm using Darwin's method of scientific reasoning. It has a name that philosophers call it, the method of multiple competing hypotheses, or the method of inference to the best explanation, where a best explanation is one which is consistent with what we know about cause and effect. So I'm using a Darwinian method of reasoning to come to a non-Darwinian conclusion, because whereas evolution can just mean change over time, Darwin went further. Darwinian evolution also is the idea that the change over time was unguided and undirected, such that there is no evidence of design in nature. And I come to the conclusion that there may be evolution, there may be change over time, but the crucial thing that needs to be explained, namely this explosion of information, is giving powerful evidence of real design, not just the appearance or the illusion of design. As a
All right, and take my second question.
Okay, you bet.
You remember
about
it.
Creationism.
Okay, yes, right.
Yeah. Intelligent design and creationism are different in two respects. In the first place, intelligent design is based on scientific evidence. It's an inference from scientific evidence. Creationism is either an interpretation or a deduction from religious authority. Secondly, when we think of creationism in the pejorative sense that's usually used in the debate, we're usually talking about the idea of young earth creationism, that your earth is extremely young, like 10,000 years old or something like that. And the theory of intelligent design really is not addressing the question of the age of the earth. I personally think it's very, very old, and assume the great antiquity of the earth in my discussion of the Cambrian explosion, and in my case for intelligent design. So intelligent design is not based on religious authority, it's based on scientific evidence, and it's not arguing for a young earth.
Very important stuff. We're going to obviously have to have a second part here. When I do, I want to invite, and stay on if you got in, I'll try to get some calls. Send me an email with challenges. Back in a moment. A game-changing book. You heard it on the day of its publication here on this Ultimate Issues Hour, Darwin's Doubt. And it is exactly about that, by a leading scientist, man with a PhD from Cambridge in philosophy of science. So the philosophy part means he knows how to write, and the science part means he knows what he's talking about, Stephen Meyer. And I have learned an immense amount thanks to his book, thanks to my ability to access him, and my ability to have him on the radio on a number of occasions. Let me just summarize some calls here, folks, and it's better that I get to a few questions rather than just one, so stay on so I can see what you want to ask here. First, quickly, Marty's been on the whole hour here in Hollywood, California. Life could have been brought here from asteroids. Your take on that theory?
My take? I don't hold to that theory. I think it's a little implausible, and some people have said, yeah, look, we've got evidence of design. Maybe the designer was some being imminent within the cosmos. Richard Dawkins actually floated that idea at the end of the film Expelled. I think my own view, and this is going beyond the science to sort of the metaphysics or the worldview question, but I think a better explanation is the theistic design approach, because you not only have evidence of design in biology well after the beginning of the universe, but as you pointed out, Dennis, in your excellent column at National Review today, there's evidence of design from the very beginning of the universe and the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry that's built into the fabric of the universe itself, and clearly no being within the cosmos could be responsible for the design parameters of the cosmos as a whole. So when you look at all the evidence, I think the theistic take on design is better.
Juan in Gainesville, Florida wants to know if you're familiar with the book, What Darwin Got Wrong.
I guess I'm not.
Okay, fine. I'm just repeating what he has said. Others tend to agree or have very specific questions. Folks, if you do want a challenge, I'd like to do a part two, and I will read your thoughtful challenges if you have them. So send them to me through my website, DennisPrager.com. The article that he mentioned is up at the National Review. They're always also up at Town Hall, but Town Hall didn't quite get it formed right on the page because I had so many zeros. You recall you saw my article.
You've also got quite a lot of response already in just a few hours having it up. It's created a buzz there. So,
thank you for that. But it doesn't compare to your book. Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. It is a very powerful work. It's accessible to any layperson. So good luck with it, Stephen Meyer. I do believe it will be a game changer. Thanks for writing it.
Thanks for having me on, Dennis.
You're very welcome. I'm Dennis Prager. This has been the Ultimate Issues Hour.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.